You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Glad you could be here. So today, May 1st, has been best known as National Decision Day. It's when deposits are due that dictate where new first-year college students will go to in the fall. It's when they commit. And hundreds of schools have moved their deadline back a month. And what life will be like in the fall, it's murky at best. We're looking into the challenges facing college students and specifically student athletes this hour. Are you a student athlete? What restrictions are in the way of you earning enough money to afford food and housing? And all college students, how are you getting by and what might you do in the fall? Join in this conversation this hour, 800-642-1234. Sarah Goldrick-Rabb is a professor of higher education policy and sociology at Temple University. She founded the Hope Center for College, Community, and Justice in Philadelphia. Sarah, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
So you have talked to hundreds of thousands of college students over the years through this survey, really understanding where they are at colleges large and small. When you look at the section who are student athletes, where are they at with food and housing insecurity?
Well, you know, the truth is we didn't know. And as researchers, we were all reading the newspaper the way everyone else does. And from time to time, you see a story about an athlete who says, yeah, I get a scholarship, but you'd be surprised. I still don't have enough to eat. So we went out there to find out and collected a lot of systematic data. And we were really surprised, actually, to see that those anecdotes, they hold up. There are a sizable number of students, I mean, even at Division I schools. So, for example, one of the biggest surprises to us was that almost 14% of the student athletes at Division I schools in our survey had experienced homelessness in the last year. And 24% had been food insecure in the prior 30 days. And this was done in the fall, this survey, before the pandemic.
So this was even before the pandemic took hold. How do you expect COVID-19 to worsen the situation for these students?
Well, I think that the number one problem that I imagine that they have is that, you know, a lot of them were working. And you know, again, kind of busting stereotypes, I think people assume that, you know, student athletes are too busy to work. And I think they are very, very busy. But the fact is that they work at very high rates, and it's clearly part of how they're making ends meet. So, for example, you know, about 60% of those Division I athletes were working at some point to make ends meet. And now people have been laid off of their jobs and their hours have been cut back. So I think that's the most immediate thing. They're going to have less money. And then the second thing is we don't really understand yet all the implications of what's happening, you know, with seasons being suspended or postponed, et cetera, for their scholarships. And finally, there are some NCAA rules that would seem like it would keep them from being able to get the extra supports that other students might be receiving right now.
I would imagine at Division II type schools where the scholarships aren't as plentiful for those student athletes that they may also be in much more difficult situations.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And one of the things that our report does, and it is on our website if anybody wants to take a look, you know, is that we break out the issues by the division of the students. And it's very clear that Division II and Division III students, plus, by the way, students who play while attending a two-year college, they are at even higher risk of food insecurity, for example. And one of the things that we were kind of stunned at is that we found rates of food insecurity for those students that were almost as high as they were for the non-athletes. So, for example, we found at the two-year colleges that 43% of non-athletes, you know, regular students, 43% had experienced food insecurity compared to 39% of athletes. Clearly, being an athlete wasn't buffering you very much. And the gap at the four-year schools was about 10%.
We're talking with Sarah Goldrick-Rabb. She founded the Hope Center for College, Community, and Justice in Philadelphia, and her research focuses on food and housing insecurity. And we want to hear from you, student athletes. Is your athletic scholarship the way you're able to afford college? How has the coronavirus pandemic complicated matters for you? College students, how are you living in this moment? What about food? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@WPR.org. Sarah, we put the terminology out there, food insecurity and housing insecurity. What does that actually mean?
Yeah, so we use the same terminology that the United States Department of Agriculture uses for anyone in this country. And food insecurity, it's related to hunger, but it's not quite the same. Essentially, it means that a person doesn't have enough money to be able to afford to eat on a regular basis. So it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to experience hunger, especially if, quite honestly, they have to skip meals every day. They may get used to it. But it means things that are more common, like, you know, a student who's cutting the size of their meals or skipping meals because they don't have enough money for food. Students who are constantly worried about these things happening. Students who might be losing weight. And the truth is that some students gain weight because of food insecurity, because the only thing they can afford is so lousy. All of these things, of course, would have implications, not just for how a student does in school, but also on the field.
In terms of housing, then, what do you look at there? Are these students couch surfing, if you will, or are they living in their cars? What does the homelessness look like?
So we use the same measure of homelessness that the United States Department of Education uses with regard to students throughout this country. It does include couch surfing, and in fact, couch surfing is one of the most common forms of homelessness in the United States. It's why so many people feel like homelessness is kind of invisible. They think they're going to see it on the street, but they're not. It means that they're staying with different people. They often don't know where they're going. For college students, that's by far the most prevalent form of homelessness.
So staying with a classmate, staying with a classmate's family, and going one to the next may be a way of getting by?
It is, and it's, you know, it's something where the uncertainty and the stress are part of it. The other thing is people need to recognize when students are couch surfing, it's often with an understanding that they will take advantage of only a limited amount of that place they're staying. So, for example, I've watched college students couch surf all the way through school, and they're told like things like you can sleep on the couch, but don't turn on the lights. Don't put your stuff in the refrigerator. Like, this is not your place is a very clear message. And it means that they can't leave their stuff there on a regular basis. You know, they don't have a place to study. So it's not like they're staying in some cushy extra bedroom being put up by, you know, a family member who has the money to have them there.
Why can't these students work? Because are there additional rules and restrictions that student athletes have to abide by?
So actually, most of the prohibitions on their employment from the NCAA have actually been lifted for some time now. They can work in theory, and as I said before, they do work. However, they have a lot less time available for work. And not only that, their schedules are such they don't make them really optimal employees. It's really easy for an employer these days when faced with a student who says, you know, I can only work the weekends or I can only work these 2 days a week to say, you know what, I'm going to go find somebody with more flexible schedules. So that really is, I think, the hardest part in terms of shouldn't they just earn money elsewhere? The fact is being a student athlete is a full-time job in and of itself.
We're looking at the situation college students are facing right now with Sarah Goldrick-Rabb. She's a higher education policy and sociology professor at Temple University. Want to hear from college students this hour. Did you rely on meal cards at school to get your food? Are you still able to get the food you need? We're at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about food and housing insecurity among college students and specifically student athletes. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Temple University higher education policy and sociologist Sarah Goldrick-Rabb really has her pulse on this. In the past 5 years, her research team has surveyed more than 330,000 students across hundreds of colleges and universities. Do you think it is the duty of the college to ensure that all students are well-nourished and have adequate housing? What financial aid reforms would remedy some of the problems that you see? Join in at 800-642-1234. Temple's Sarah Goldrick-Rabb stays with us for the hour. And now let's bring in Erin McGoy. She played Division I collegiate water polo at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. until her graduation in 2018. Erin, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me. This is like morning practice hour.
I bet it is. So at the time, and you're graduated now, but what did your scholarship cover for water polo and how much did it stretch?
Yeah, definitely. So I received a partial scholarship to play Division I water polo at George Washington University. That stacked with an academic scholarship, financial aid, and me participating in a work-study job all 4 years of college really enabled me to attend GW, but there were some gaps, especially with our meal plan. It wasn't unlimited, so kind of a common occurrence was that we would run out of meal money halfway through the semester, and then that's when I started to run into the troubles of food insecurity. And then as I went from freshman to sophomore, sophomore to junior, and the cost of housing increased, I also experienced some housing insecurity.
So what did you do? Where did you turn to?
Yeah, so I when I ran out of meal money, I lived a freegan lifestyle where I tried to survive off free food from different university events. So I subscribed to all these different university listservs and student groups and would basically plan my week around events that I knew had free food. After weights, we would receive a protein bar, and I would always try to take an extra one or ask my teammates to give me one of theirs. I would go to sleep right after an evening workout so that I didn't have to pay for dinner. And my senior year, when my housing insecurity was at my worst, I would actually board dogs in my no-dog apartment. So I would take them in through my back door and board up to two dogs at a time on top of all the other responsibilities I had. But boarding those dogs in my apartment was what enabled me to pay rent. So it was, you know, kind of seemed like my only option.
Did you feel like there were others like you out there? Could you confide in anyone about this?
It was definitely really hard. I definitely felt alone. I did create a Facebook group while I was at GW called Free Food in Foggy Bottom to kind of share my freegan lifestyle. And that got around 500 users. So that was the first time I thought, okay, maybe, you know, there's like a small group of GW students out there who feel the same that I do. And then my senior year, when the report that was co-authored by Sarah Goldrick-Rabb showing that almost 40% of GW students are food insecure, I was like, oh, wow, I'm not alone at all. Just no one's talking about this.
Sarah Goldrick-Rabb, is there shame out there among college students to ask for help, to know that, you know, others are doing similar things to get by, to make it?
There's tremendous shame. And, you know, to be honest, I think that's why so many of us didn't know about this problem, those of us who were not students. I mean, I distinctly remember the first time that my research team heard from a student about this challenge in 2008 at one of the Wisconsin universities. She confided and she immediately collapsed into tears. And the same thing happened when I first got to Temple University. Another young woman came to me within the first month of my being there and again confided in what was happening. They feel profoundly alone, and many of them actually think in some way that they have caused this problem, that this is their fault.
We're talking with Sarah Goldrick-Rabb, researches food and housing insecurity in higher education. Erin McGoy played Division I collegiate water polo and now runs an organization called Last Call. There's room for you in this conversation. Were you a student athlete who struggled to stay afloat in college? How are you doing today? And college students, What changes do you want to see in higher ed around basic living necessities? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So, Erin, as a student athlete, what kind of restrictions were in place around working during this season or accepting meals from people? What types of terms were you under?
Yeah, so I had a work study job, so I know that that was allowed. And I actually didn't run into any restrictions on behalf of accepting food, or maybe I accepted food that I shouldn't have but didn't know. But I didn't run into a ton of those restrictions.
This situation, though, led you to a career. You actually created a startup company connecting students mm-hmm. with inexpensive meals. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, definitely. So right around the time that report that 40% of GW students are food insecure came out, coupled with a summer internship on the food waste team at the World Wildlife Fund, where I learned that 40% of food produced is wasted. As an environmentalist, it made me really sad to hear about the negative environmental impacts of food waste. And as a, hungry collegiate student athlete, I was so angry. I, thought there's no way that these two huge social problems should be happening at the same time. So I my senior year, I just started reaching out to restaurants. I asked if they'd be willing to sell their, surplus food at a discounted rate to college students. And last year we served almost 600 students in the GW area.
What is the situation like now with COVID-19? I know I was on your website this morning and I saw that you have some resources there.
Yeah, definitely. So what we saw with COVID-19 was that a lot of the college students, dispersed across the country. So, they weren't in that centralized area. So I have been, checking in with our college students and engaging them on certain things. And we've actually pivoted to offer affordable meal delivery to vulnerable communities. So now we actually just launched last week and have served over 150 meals to the disabled, elderly, and low income in Washington, D.C.
Sarah, do you see the concept of last call? Are you seeing that anywhere else in the country, or do you think that this is something that might help the situation?
Yeah, I mean, what's wonderful, and when I first heard from Erin, was that, there's this tremendous outgrowth of former students who have experienced these things or known someone who did, who are innovating to try to help. So there's another organization that does somewhat similar things called Sharing Excess that is in Philadelphia and is a student at Drexel University. There's a really innovative program called Swipe Out Hunger that was started by a group of UCLA students, and one in particular who has really grown this into a national organization. There's another one called Challah for Hunger that's a Jewish-run organization on campuses around the country. They all take slightly different approaches to addressing campus food insecurity, but what's so important is that they take it seriously and they do the very best that they can. The other thing is many of them recognize that this is an issue both for students on campuses and in the communities around the campuses.
Erin, how do you want to see the NCAA respond to the situation that some student athletes are facing here with homelessness and food insecurity?
I think NCAA and university sports departments' number one focus should be the well-being of their student athletes. Because if we're not feeling 100%, we can't be expected to give our 100% in our sport.
Sarah, do you see any changes coming down from the NCAA that this could be addressed in the future in a different way?
There have been a few signals. One of the things that I've seen discussed in a few pieces is a potential emergency aid fund that could be available. I think it's, one of the things that's always really struck me is that they have restrictions on third-party assistance. And there have been some stories about that. For example, there was a student who was homeless while he was playing football at Baylor. And if a family helped him out, which they tried to, he would get in trouble and lose his NCAA eligibility. It seems to me like this is a good moment for everyone to ask themselves who benefits when students are kept from support. that the university and the NCAA both don't have to pay for. You know, why would it be that, especially during the pandemic, but in general times, when a student doesn't have food or housing, what's wrong with someone else stepping up to support them in some way? Are we really that concerned that they're going to be unduly influenced?
Erin,
you know.
Yeah. And Erin, how are you doing today? Very quickly.
I'm doing well. I definitely get a lot of joy working with these passionate college students who have the same fire to fight these inequalities of food insecurity on college campuses. So it's definitely it's very rewarding for me to work with them. My food security has increased. So that's very good.
Well, Erin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Erin McGoy played Division I collegiate water polo at George Washington University, and she founded a college food insecurity nonprofit. It's called Last Call. Temple University Professor Sarah Goldrick-Rabb stays with us. She runs the country's largest, longest-running annual survey of basic needs insecurity among college students. With your questions on this at 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up after a news update here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Just a quick mention that there are many questions about COVID-19. We have the Wisconsin Project, which is collecting questions. You could submit yours. We'll do our best to track down an answer. Go to WPR.org/COVID. Right now, we're talking about the challenges that college students and student athletes are faced with during the pandemic. Recent survey data suggests that 1 in 6 college students have already changed their plans about going to college in the fall, deciding to forego attending a 4-year college full time. And some of those are students who had already submitted a deposit. So what is your situation like? What do you think colleges and universities could be doing right now for students? Join in at 800-642-1234. We have Sarah Goldrick-Rabb for the hour. She's a higher education policy and sociology professor at Temple University. And her latest report from the Hope Center looks at food and housing insecurity among student athletes. So, Sarah, you had mentioned that the COVID-19 crisis has limited the types of jobs that people can do, that college students can do. Many college students work in restaurants, which have been shuttered for the most part. Can students who have lost their jobs turn to unemployment insurance for assistance?
You know, some of them can, and frankly, anyone who thinks that they might be qualified should apply. This is a time when it's absolutely necessary to look for all forms of assistance that they might possibly be eligible for, and UI is certainly one of those things. SNAP is another one of those things. SNAP is the food program, formerly known as food stamps. The other thing is that if you are able to file your taxes while the deadline was extended, it still may be worth doing it because there are refundable tax credits that you might qualify for, which could put money in your hands now.
How might the pandemic influence student decisions, in student athlete decisions as well, about what college looks like for them next fall? Could we see a vastly different situation on our campuses?
I think we are going to see a vastly different situation. You know, none of us has a crystal ball in terms of what the pandemic is going to do, but there is precedent here. If you think back to 2008 and the Great Recession and that onset, there's really no question that it changed many students' trajectories with regard to being able to afford college and therefore where to go and when to go. The shift might be from full-time to part-time as they try to do some work while going to school to make it possible. Others, I think, are going to end up taking what we call a gap year, which isn't nearly as fun as it sounds. and others, I think, will say that they're going to live at home while they go to school in an effort to make that more affordable, although, to be honest, it doesn't always make it that much more affordable.
Kenneth from Janesville called in, couldn't stay with us, and said this issue is really revolving around the universities and colleges themselves. They should provide and make sure students are food secure. What type of reforms could you see that might be possible from universities on this?
Well, I agree with him that they have a role to play. And certainly, you know, for example, one really interesting question is who has access to the training table? I think a lot of people assume that all athletes do. And I'm frequently told that's not the case. So I think getting some clarity on that is really important. I would also think that to the extent it seems clear that athletes are trying to work outside of sports in order to make this happen, there is a robust discussion about the extent to which, you know, their performance, their athletic participation should count as a job, or they should be paid in some way. But I also think even beyond that, there are interesting questions about the potential for helping them find jobs that are not really taxing and that will consistently hire them so that they know they have some steady income. But I also want to flag one really big thing. We cannot pretend like these institutions are all wealthy. You know, you are in Wisconsin, and there are a handful of institutions there, really only one or two with any significant endowments. The others are always living on the financial brink. And so we've got to wrestle with the fact there's a bigger role to be played here by state and federal governments and by the NCAA.
When you talk with first-generation students, I would imagine there are some pretty difficult conversations right now with students who may be a quarter away, a semester away from graduating, but their families are struggling. They've lost their jobs and saying, hey, you need to help out here. We can't do this anymore. What might that look like for those students who are so close and yet may not be able to get there?
Yeah, we've been seeing this for a long time. And again, it's another area that we saw happen with the Great Recession. I mean, I think the first thing is those students have often been going through those challenges throughout college. We often picture, you know, because the financial aid system says that every parent pays their child's expenses, we overlook the extent to which children regularly contribute to their family's expenses while they're in college. And this happens especially for first-gen students. Yes, I think it's more intense now. And yes, I do think it can be a draw away from even finishing those last couple semesters. I hope that those individuals and their families can have a very hard conversation, though, about the much greater financial promise of actually getting the credential. Dropping out of college with no credential is going to put them at enormous financial risk, particularly when their student loans become due.
We're talking with Sarah Goldrick-Rabb, who teaches higher education policy and sociology at Temple University, and she takes a close look at food insecurity and homelessness among student athletes. Let's hear from you. Do you think student athletes should be able to profit from their status or to be paid to play? How can the NCAA adapt its rules to the needs of its athletes? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Let's take a call now. Brad is with us from Janesville. Hi, Brad.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. My question is a bit of a tangent. A friend of mine is recently 18 years old, living on her own, tried to apply for a stimulus check, was told she submitted the wrong form and that she's missed a deadline now. I'm checking to see whether or not she can still get her $1,200 stimulus check, even though she's recently an adult and has never before filled out state or federal income tax returns.
Brad, thank you for that question. Sarah, what do we know about the support through the federal stimulus package?
I mean, I think the first thing that we know is that it excluded a whole lot of people in the age range that he's describing. And I worry that perhaps she has been excluded. That said, I would first and foremost be persistent. Go and ask additional questions about what exactly she missed, and then go to your elected official if need be. They're hearing from their constituents right now with all sorts of questions about the stimulus. And it is worth going and asking if they will look into it because, you know, people genuinely do need the money, and certainly missing a form or missing some sort of deadline, a lot of that bureaucratic nonsense, unfortunately, leads people to just quit the process. Don't quit. Keep trying.
So the aid in this package stands for students at about $7 billion. Is that right?
Well, so that's You're referring to the CARES Act.
The CARES, right. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, the stimulus payments that are most people are referring to are for sort of everybody in theory, although they cut out a lot of college students. The CARES Act includes, it's actually closer to $6.5 billion of emergency aid. The way that that's working is, first, Congress authorized the money. Second, the Department of Education made a bunch of rules about the money, and then the colleges and universities went to work trying to get it out the door. What's really unfortunate is that after 2 weeks of the colleges doing their work to get the money out the door, the Department of Education reversed themselves on a number of the rules. So to the extent the money's not out the door right now, that's why. Colleges and universities suffered a major setback as the Department of Education intervened to cut out about 1.5 million students from that support. The support will come, and you should keep an eye on your college or university's website for how the CARES money can be accessed.
And so what would this financial aid, what would the CARES Act go toward for the students? How could it help alleviate any of these pressures right now?
So it is explicitly designed as emergency aid, and it is explicitly intended for things like food and housing expenses, child care expenses, things that are about your cost of living that might have been impacted due to the campus closures. So that doesn't just mean you were living in a residence hall and you were displaced. It can also mean, for example, that you were living off campus, but you got your meals from a campus food pantry, and the campus food pantry closed, and now you've had to purchase additional meals, and that's affecting you. You should be eligible to get food support if your college and university has structured this properly.
So what conversations should students be having right now with their financial aid office? Should they be communicating with that financial aid office if they are struggling to make any type of housing, food issues, or if their financial status has changed dramatically?
They absolutely should. I want to direct them to a brand new free resource that will help them approach their financial aid office. It's called Swift Student. It's formswift.com/swift-student. And the reason this is so helpful is that all of those appeal forms, all of those things that help the student communicate with their aid office, this website has the templates for these students to use. It will make their job so much easier in sending that question to the financial aid office rather than trying to come up with the right language for how to explain what it is they think they need.
We're talking with Temple University sociologist Sarah Goldrick-Rabb this hour, describing the complexities that college students face right now in the pandemic. Still time for your questions, your story, your situation at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. We'll be back in just a moment with Sarah Goldrick-Rabb right here on the Ideas Network. Morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. With more than 30 million Americans now out of work, paying for college in many families looks a whole lot different than it did when students applied for financial aid, often back in the fall. Light years, it seems, before we knew about COVID-19. We're looking at the destabilizing effects on college students. Students at some universities have started organizing to demand tuition refunds. Some have sued, arguing that online classes aren't what they paid for. So where do you see progress among colleges in helping their students? What are the bright spots you see? Still time to talk. Take your questions, 800-642-1234. We have Temple University sociologist and higher education policy professor Sarah Goldrick-Rabb talking about the situation and what can be done. Let's bring in Peggy now in Casco this morning. Hi, Peggy.
Hi.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Well, I've done taxes professionally for years and years, but what I'm seeing is that student that just called in is wondering where her $1,200 check is, and she's 18. If everything is tied into the IRS. That's where a lot of information is coming from for these checks. That means chances are very good she was still dependent on her parents' return. Therefore, the parents would have received the $500.
And that $500 could be passed on to the student if they are a dependent.
Because if these students are considered dependent on last year's tax return, that means the parents received the $500 even though the child is away at college.
Peggy, thank you so much for bringing that up. Sarah, you know, navigating all of these resources and keeping tabs on what funding is available can be very difficult. How could we help students at this point, you know, navigate these systems?
Right. So that's exactly why I was suggesting that she continue to ask questions to get clarity on what the situation could be. I don't want to make any assumptions about whether her parents even filed, frankly, not knowing the exact situation. And there is a tremendous amount of complexity depending on whether or not she's actually enrolled in college full time or part time and those sorts of things. The system was built not to make it easy for students. It's not meant to make it easy for anybody. In fact, government stance is generally that it should be hard for you, and only if you're successful at navigating it do you actually, quote-unquote, deserve the support. Once people understand that, I think they understand that they have to lean in even harder and be persistent. So that is the most general and strong advice I can say, which is do not give up. Look for every possible resource and ask everyone you know what your options might be.
So with colleges forcing, you know, to move to online learning through the end of the year and maybe going forward, who knows when, what are they doing, if anything, to compensate students for what has been lost and moving into a digital realm with all their classes?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing is I totally understand that students are financially stressed. I hear from them every day. I understand why they want things like their tuition back, and I understand why online's not the same. Online has never been the same. I am a little hard-pressed, though, to recommend the move that they're making to ask for their money back on their classes, because the truth is it's not clear what choice that institutions have. It's not like they decided to switch to online. They were forced to switch to online because of a pandemic, and a pandemic that arguably government has more responsibility for than these institutions. So, you know, if the institution had closed and had to shut down even then, it wouldn't have been a choice. I think the students need to ask themselves, do they want to be able to maintain their progress towards a degree, which online courses at least help with, or do they want there to literally be a pause in their education? Housing and food refunds for unused meal plans, for example, are a different story. But the colleges, they had to pay their staff to prepare and teach, whether it's online or in person, regardless. So they're not exactly sitting on any extra money here.
What do you see in the digital divide? Are students capable of logging on and just continuing to carry out their classes online?
No, I mean, I think we all know that it's simply not the case that everybody has broadband access, and Wisconsin folks know that as well as anybody else. I've driven all over that state, and I know exactly where, you know, you don't have cell access, you don't have broadband. It isn't realistic. So I think that, online only is never, ever going to be equitable in this country until we solve a slew of technological issues. And I'm hoping that this does cause us to lean in harder to those issues. But the fact is, even when you have broadband access, first-generation college students, those who have prior negative academic experiences, they do not do as well in online courses. This is just a fact. And it's why at some point we've got to get back to having some form of in-person education.
Sarah, as you move forward with your surveys, and you've surveyed so many students over the years, what are you going to be looking for moving forward as we are amid a pandemic and at some point on the other side of this pandemic? How does your research adjust and change?
Well, I'll tell you, it's been a heck of a couple of 6 to 8 weeks here from my research team. We've been going nonstop, especially as we try to help the students and the colleges directly. One of the things we did was we put a COVID survey into the field. It's out there right now at about 60 colleges around the United States collecting information on how the students are doing so that we can see if, in fact, those food and housing rates of insecurities are going up. We have a fall survey coming this fall. If anybody goes to our website, hopeforcollege4.com, you'll be able to sign your college up for the fall survey. And there will be a lot of attention in there, not only to the troubles the students are facing, but to the extent to which they are getting and accessing support, both from government resources and from campus resources. And I think that's going to be critical. We can no longer say we have a campus food pantry, that's sufficient. It clearly isn't. It's not enough to say we have a campus emergency aid program. We have to ask, are the students who need it actually connecting with it? And what can we do to help them connect?
We don't have many minutes left, but I want to just touch on international students at this time. How do you see colleges and universities handling these students who have abruptly had to stop their classes and are, you know, hours and hours and continents away from home?
You know, the colleges and universities actually were stepping up to help these international students, and many of them were planning on using the CARES dollars to support them. That's why it's so troubling that Secretary of Education DeVos came out only about a week ago now and decided the international students are ineligible for the CARES dollars, along with undocumented students, along with many LGBTQ students, justice-impacted students. There are so many folks who cannot file a FAFSA, but they are students just like anyone else here, and they contribute revenue to both our tax base and to the colleges, and now they're being left short. So I think it's unfortunate the colleges and universities have been hamstrung like this. And I think that if we're concerned about these folks, because we know, honestly, they're going to have to lean on their communities more for public assistance, frankly, because we didn't help them in this way, I think that we need to make that clear to our elected officials.
And finally, last thoughts on student athletes. How will you follow up with your survey as you watch the developments on this front with student athletes?
Well, there's a lot of things that we want to know more about. I mean, of course, we want to know what happens this fall and what the implications are for them. We're also going to be asking some additional questions because we want to understand really whether they're on full or partial scholarship or no scholarship at all when we're looking, for example, at a student who's homeless. And we're going to be trying to tease that out. The other thing is we're going to be asking more about their sports because we don't know what they actually play. And we want to be also clear about whether or not they have access to the training table. So, you know, among the surveys that go out this fall, those additional questions will be there. We certainly hope that athletes feel safe enough to answer these questions. In light of this pandemic, it's more important than ever that decisions be made on good data. And that's what we're hoping to contribute to the conversation.
Sarah, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah Goldrick-Rabb is a professor of higher education policy and sociology at Temple University, founded the Hope Center for College, Community, and Justice in Philadelphia. We have resources she mentioned, by the way, at WPR.org/mornings. And earlier, we talked with Aaron McGoy, who played Division I collegiate water polo at George Washington University. Just ahead, it is On Point, more than 30 million Americans without work. The On Point News Roundtable takes that up. That's next. I'm Kate Archer Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.